Good morning. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. These are the words Luke records the large crowd exclaiming as Jesus made his entry into Jerusalem the week before his death. And today, on Palm Sunday, we remember that triumphal entry. We imagine the crowd hurriedly hacking off branches like the kids have now from the trees, coats being ripped off and tossed in the road, laid before the king, and voices raised so high that those Pharisees, normally such a chill crowd, couldn't help but complain. But then in his account of this, Luke makes a tonal shift in the narrative. He writes this: the king, we know he's riding on a colt, so the crowds are casting garments down for his beast to muddy. The Pharisees, again, are whining. Jesus boldly says, if the people were quiet, the rocks themselves would shout out praise. It's a scene of rejoicing, devoted masses, a conquering king. But then the shift. Luke writes this in chapter 19, verse 41 of his account, and when he, Jesus, drew near and saw the city Jerusalem, he wept over it. You have the conquering king, crowds at his back, waving branches, tearing off their garments, shouting Hosanna, and then Jesus sees Jerusalem and weeps. With his eyes in the city, Jesus says this: would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. Why was Jerusalem blind to the things that make for peace? And we get a picture if you flip back in Luke's account to chapter 13, verse 34, where Jesus also declares about Jerusalem. He says, oh, Jerusalem, the Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings? And then he says, and you were not willing. They were not willing. The day of his triumphal entry, they didn't know what made for true peace. They'd been blinded to the truth because they didn't truly want it. God had sent prophets. They didn't want them. They killed them to prove it. And now we know that God had sent his very son, and Jesus knew what was going to happen next. He was literally the answer they needed, the peace that they needed, but they didn't want him. They didn't want Jesus. They might have wanted something of him, but not what he had come for. John, in John's account of the triumphal entry, he tells us that many people in that palm-waving crowd were there because, not because they wanted Jesus necessarily, but they had heard what Jesus did with Lazarus, bringing him back to life. So perhaps they were asking themselves, what sign will he do next? Others we know wanted Jesus to come, and they wanted him for a while, till they realized he wasn't the political conquering person they thought he was. In their minds, they were probably asking, how soon is he going to conquer Rome? They weren't asking, how soon will he liberate us, me, from my sins? They didn't want him because they were asking the wrong questions. And until they asked the wrong questions, until they asked the right questions, they would never be interested in the answers he came to truly offer. And so Jesus weeps, being himself the truth they needed, being what they needed, having the answer in himself, but weeping because they didn't want him. Their interests were far too small. He wanted to bring lasting peace between God and man, something far deeper than mere physical healing or mere political freedom. Now, I think we all understand today, we are not the Messiah. This is not Jerusalem. But I think many of you could probably relate in some way to our king here, where you've probably at some point in your life had some truth you wanted to share with someone, you knew it could help them, set them free, and you've seen that person dig in their heels, stick out their chin, and turn and walk away and not listen. And when that happens, weeping, like Christ did here, is a fitting response. But this morning, we're not just going to weep together. If you know me well, I'm essentially incapable of public crying, so barring a miracle, that's not going to happen anyway. Instead, what I want to consider this morning is, how can we press on in such a context? How do we share truth that no one wants to hear? Now, I'm using no one as a bit of hyperbole, of course, but college campuses are one of the more hostile places to the Christian worldview generally and to the pro-life case specifically, and yet that is where God has sent created equal. And so much of my ministry is sharing truth with a population that just frankly doesn't want to hear it. And what I've realized when I face a crowd that wants us to just go home and take our signs out and never come back, I've realized we face a similar problem as what we saw or as what was seen in Jerusalem. People don't want truth that we desperately want to share with them, because they're just not interested in the right questions. So this morning, I'm going to do two things together. I'm going to consider how, in that context, how in the context of the abortion debate, we can help people ask the right questions. And then once we've done that, how can we lead them to the right answers? Right questions, right answers. That's our goal. Along the way, you'll get to meet some of the colorful people that I've met on campus. And in all of this, our goal will be to encourage all of us together in a journey so that when we face cities, crowds, or individuals who don't want truth, we'll have ideas of how to share it with them in spite of that. All right, so late last year, when the deadlies were curling on the pavements, our team went to Youngstown State University in Youngstown, Ohio, set up all of our signs showing babies killed by abortion, and after a couple of hours of asking students walking by, what do you think about that, and engaging conversation, a very pregnant Elizabeth McCulfer and I grabbed a couple of microphones for what we call open mic, where students can ask any question they want or make any comment they want into one microphone, and we respond in the other. And it's always a very lively exchange, and that day was no different. One elderly lady stopped as she was walking by, just railed at me, said, "You have no right to be here because you're a man." And I'm always so fascinated in this day and age when the most progressive people can instantly know my gender when I have a microphone in my hand. They just, there's no question. The students also lost their mind when I suggested, maybe not the most winsomely, but I suggested maybe you should exchange your phrase, "my body, my choice," for a more fitting one of "her body, my choice," because that's not your body. You want control over someone else's body. They lost their minds. In the middle of all of this, one guy came forward and grabbed Lizbeth's microphone. He was a STEM major, so science, technology, engineering, math. He said, "You have no right to be here because you are inherently religious in your views." Now imagine the applause just echoed throughout the crowd. Like, this was the message they all wanted to say, but he was the one who put few words to what they all felt inside. After the clapping died down, I asked him a question. I said, "So what do you believe in?" He said, "I don't have religion. I believe in science." Now the irony of his statement was completely lost on him, right? He had a religion. It wasn't the time-tested faith of historic Christianity. It was the fairly new religion of scientism, the idea that science can answer every question we have to ask. My point today is not a full response to scientism. Here's my point. He didn't want our message because he was unwilling to engage questions he found to be religious. Now hold that in your mind for a moment and travel with me to the Ohio State University in Columbus, where just last week I met another STEM major, this one a woman, who was passing out pro-abortion fundraising lit. And as soon as I gave a shred of scientific evidence that the baby's a human, she lost her mind and said, "You cannot talk about science, only ethics." So she was the flip side of the other STEM major, not wanting to talk about science, only ethics. Two STEM majors, one insisting it's only science we're dealing with. The other one, no, it's only ethics. They're both wrong. They're both asking one good question, but that's not enough. There are two categories of questions we have to answer in this question, in this debate. And clarifying this, I think, is the most overlooked step in the abortion debate or in any conversation where you're sharing truth with someone who doesn't want it. Before you get to the case you want to share, you've got to prepare someone to understand it. Think of Francis Schaeffer's idea of pre-evangelism, right? If you jump in with John 3:16 before giving someone any reason to believe God exists, that there's good reason to believe Jesus was raised from the dead, they might dismiss the whole idea of the atonement as a fairy tale, not bad, but silly and irrelevant in this new age. In the abortion debate, we have two categories of questions we want people to consider. Each of the STEM majors had one of them, but that's not enough. We have to bring them together. If people are going to understand the truth of abortion, they must understand these kinds of questions, the categories of questions, before we give them answers. Now, to underscore what that is, let's look together at the case against abortion. Oh, there's a picture from Youngstown State. That's not Lizbeth, though. All right, so let's underscore the questions we have to answer by first looking at the case against abortion, reviewing it for us. Three simple lines. You all know this by heart, I'm sure, but this is why abortion is wrong. This is the truth we want people to accept. First, it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Number two, elective abortion does that. It intentionally kills innocent human beings. Three, therefore, it is wrong. That's the case against abortion. That's why it's wrong. That is the truth we want to lead people to understand. Now, the two premises there generally represent the two categories of questions we're asking. Let's go back. We're starting number two there. Elective abortion intentionally kills innocent humans. Now, that premise there is mostly an issue of science, right? How do we know the embryo is human? Scientific inquiry. How do we know abortion kills her? Look at the procedures. It's pretty clear, right? But look at premise number one. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent humans. Moral wrongness is not an element of science. As soon as you say anything is morally wrong, or that we should act in a certain way to be moral, we've departed science and we've entered, well, call it what you want, we've entered religion, ethics, philosophy, or more generally, we've entered worldview. These are the two categories, science and worldview, we have to entertain. The STEM majors each picked their favorite and said, this is all we need, science or religion. They picked their favorite and stuck with that, but that's never going to lead to a conclusion, whether you're for or against abortion. We need both these categories. With science, we can determine what the embryo is, if she's human or not, but we need the bigger worldview questions to know how we ought to treat her, if she is equal to all of us. And sadly, I find a lot of pro-life people miss this. Some insist today our case is only all about science. And I imagine they're kind of frustrated by how we're all painted as backward, anti-science weirdos. But this isn't just about science. With science alone, we'd know the baby's a human, but we'd never know if she's equal to us, how we ought to treat her. For all of us, pro-life or pro-choice, we must enter into not only science, but also the wider worldview questions. That's exactly what the first STEM major wanted to avoid. But of course, he didn't. I mean, he even admitted he believed in something. He'd made a poor choice believing in making his God science, because it's a poor choice because science can't answer so many of the big questions that really matter to us, but he still believed in something, right? Now, in a moment, we'll review how good science does lead us to good answers on what the embryo is. But first, let's entertain the worldview question, right? When you ask the worldview question, is the embryo equal to us, what do we all conclude? Well, Christians, it's pretty simple for us, right? The embryo is equal to us because God made the entire class of humans in his image, not just men, not just humans with certain skin color, not just those old enough to be born, all humans. Genesis 1, it could not be clear. Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Now, what about the abortion advocate? He may think he can avoid the worldview question, is she equal to us? Is it right to kill her? But he can't. He's taken a position that the embryo is not deserving of the same protection all of us deserve, or the same protection a toddler has, because he's in favor of killing the preborn child when he wouldn't allow killing the born child. And maybe he hasn't carefully evaluated this worldview question, but he's nevertheless come to a conclusion on it that the baby is not equal to us. So now here's my point so far. Everyone takes a position on worldview questions of whether humans matter, whether we're all created equal, whether it's moral to kill innocent members of the human family. We all take a position on this. Some people try to dismiss these questions as uniquely religious, but everyone engages in worldview, not just Christians. Others, as I mentioned, tell us just stick to science, to drop science and stick to religion. We can't do that either. We need both science and religion, or science and worldview. Both questions, scientific and wider worldview ones, we need both to come to a conclusion. And until we lead people to consider both categories of questions, these two together, they're never going to want the message we have because they don't understand the kinds of questions we are asking. So before we present the message, we need to make sure they understand the kinds of questions we are asking in this conversation. So to illustrate what this looks like in dialogue, how we can navigate this, let's go to one more campus, University of Toledo. This is a school where they must have some special closet in this school where they keep all of their pro-abortion signs, because for the better part of a decade, they not only have been using the same slogan, but literally the same signs year after year every time we come there. They have one they love above all. It says, if you can control my body, can I control yours? It has a crudely drawn scissors on it, and they love to shove that in the men's faces on our team. I'll let you come to your own conclusion what they mean about that with that slogan. But on this campus last fall, one female student came up to me and said, this is just uniquely religious, isn't it? Now, I knew where she was going, right? She thought religion was somehow beneath her. That she didn't need to consider my case because it was all about religion and she had nothing to do with that. So my goal was not to double down on my case against abortion, not yet at least. I needed to get her to step back and consider the kinds of questions we're asking before I could even help her answer those questions, before she could really assess the pro-life case. So when she said, this is just religion, isn't it? I said, well, okay, hang on. There are two questions here, right? First, what is abortion? Scientific study informs us the abortion is killing a human being, all right? Neither your religion nor mine can change that, any more than either of our religions could change the shape of the earth, right? You may believe the earth is flat, you don't change the shape. You are wrong in your belief. The earth is still not flat, even if you believe it. But then I said, yes, there is a second question here. That's fair. Is that human equal to you and me? And I confessed to her, yeah, I admit my religion informs me that all humans are equal. But then I asked her, what about you? What do you believe about this? You may disagree with my specific worldview, but do you agree with the conclusion from my worldview that all humans are equal? I find that this defangs the whole you're just religious statement, because I'm very willing to admit my worldview, my faith in Jesus, but I want to be clear about the role that it plays in the abortion debate. I don't use the Bible to prove the embryo is a human being. Scientific questions demand scientific answers. But the Bible does lead me to conclude that all humans are inherently equal. And once I put it that way, I find many people say, okay, you know what? I agree with you on equality. I rejected Christianity, but I agree on that conclusion on equality. And then we can move forward even if we disagree on specific theology. And that's when we get to finally an honest conversation, because at that point, we both acknowledge, okay, there are at least two things at play here. There is science, but there's also worldview, deeper questions of worldview. And they're willing now at that point to engage both those questions honestly. Because after all, every one of us is religious. It's just that some of us don't admit it. All right, so once we have the proper categories in mind, we recognize that we're going to be talking about two things here, science and worldview, both, not just one or the other, but both of them. Then I think they're ready, people we talk to, for the case against abortion. And that leads, of course, to, but how do you share this case, right? I think we should just make it super simple. Answer one good question in both those categories, science and worldview, and we can get to a good conclusion. So first, the scientific question, is the embryo human? And second, this with a worldview, is she equal to us? Now, to navigate this, I want to introduce you to someone else I met at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. I was in the middle of outreach on this campus, talking to students, when I saw this large dinosaur ambling my way. Now, I'm a pretty basic person, so dinosaurs are not only a great thing for me, but being basic, I love. The T-Rex is my favorite, so seeing this walking my way, for a moment, the child within me was excited, until, as you can see, I also realized it's just a guy inside named Daniel. Now, Daniel repeatedly insisted through the conversation he really is a dinosaur. I had enough coffee that morning to see through it. He's not really. But anyhow, so I said, what do you think about abortion? Now, Daniel turned it back on me. He said, well, what do you think about abortion? So I summarized the same thing I just told you. I said, well, Dan, I think it's wrong to purposefully kill innocent humans. Abortion does that, and so abortion is wrong. But Dan countered and said, ah, but how do you define humanity? He tossed this question out there like some, you know, deep philosophical question stemming from the dusty annals of history, but it's really not. Remember the categories, science and worldview. What something is, human or not, is not a matter of deep, dusty philosophy. It's simple science. Religion and philosophy will come in later. Now, Dan, to his credit, got this pretty quickly. Other students, when I talk to them and try to clarify that what the embryo is a scientific matter, it's a little harder for them. They don't quite grasp it as quickly. So what I love to do is just walk, bend down and pick up pluck a blade of grass or hold a leaf and say, look at this leaf. Is this a human? 9 out of 10 say no. Now that 1 out of 10 still says, I was at Bowling Green again. Bowling Green, once one girl looked at the leaf in my hand and said, maybe. I said, wait, hang on a second. This leaf you're saying is a human? She said, yeah, maybe. Totally not ashamed of her statement. Now, that's modern education, I guess. Right? But most of us look at the leaf and say, of course that's not a human. I said, well, why not? And they say, well, we could study the leaf, look at its makeup, and clearly see it's not a human being. And then I say, yeah. Let's do the same thing with the embryo, right? And at least at that point, we're in the right realm, the realm of scientific questions. But back to Dan. When Dan said, but how do you define humanity? I responded in a way that I honestly don't use too much these days. And not because it's wrong, but because I find it so seldom compelling with people like him. I quoted to him from Moore, Persaud, and Torsh's embryology textbook, The Developing Human. And I explained that they say in their textbook very clearly the one-celled zygote is a distinct, living, whole human. This is right, this is true, it should be compelling. I just find a lot of students, when they look at the book, they get bored or they think, well, it's probably slanted anyway, and they just move on. So what I find more fruitful when navigating a dialogue on this scientific question is something simpler. I borrow from author of Love Unleashes Life, Stephanie Gray Connors, and ask a simple question. If the embryo's not alive, why do you need an abortion? And just pause. And the light bulbs go off, and they say, oh wait, I guess the abortion stops the embryo from growing. I said, okay, good, right? So dead things don't grow. This embryo must therefore be alive. And they're quick to say, oh, hang on a second, sure, alive but not a human, right? And this is a quick retort that many say. Now, Adia, my daughter, is now 11, but many of you here have known us for a long time. You remember her as a toddler. As a toddler, she had a way with words, which is to say, rather blunt, right? And one time we were in the backyard playing in our old turtle sandbox, and she said, Dad, just really weird, I don't know why this came up. She said, Dad, wouldn't it be weird if humans could have a dog and be its parents? But humans can't have dogs, only dogs can. Adia got at 3 what most people have forgotten today after advanced education. That is, very simply, when two beings procreate, what they make is the same species as them, right? It's pretty simple. So cats make cats, dogs make dogs, humans make, it's really simple, right? Everyone knows humans. Okay, so you know I love questions, those who know me well. And so I love questions when they're in the right category. So another question I use along this line to get to the scientific answer of what the embryo is I like to hold up a picture of an embryo and say, okay, this embryo is inside a human being, a woman, right? So what kind of embryo is this? This question makes people squirm. It's really easy, but they squirm. I say, what kind of embryo is this? The honest ones will say, it's a human like her mother. But the really not honest ones perform some mental gymnastics that are really impressive but reveal quite a weakness of thought. Let's go back to Daniel. Daniel Dino, right? All right, so Daniel, to his credit, he admitted, sure, it's a human being, I get you, I'm with you. So he and I checked the box on the scientific question. He understood the question, what the embryo is a scientific one. He agreed with me that she's a human, science was done. Okay, we can move on. But Dan was not done. He countered and said, ah, but that human is inside someone else. They can't have human rights. Man, he set me up too perfectly for this. I said, Dan, you're in a dinosaur right now, right? Does that mean you don't have human rights being inside a T-Rex? He was pretty uncomfortable with that idea. So I just drilled the point home, right? I said, where you are is not who you are, inside a building, inside a costume, inside a uterus. That's irrelevant to who you are, your inherent value, your personhood. Now, at this point, Dan and I had moved on from science to wider questions of philosophy, religion, worldview, right? How do we see humans? Is it moral to kill young, innocent humans? Science cannot answer this for us. We need bigger worldview questions to figure this out. And once people like Dan thus recognize the baby is an embryo, the worldview questions I like, you could ask anyone, but the worldview one I like to ask is just, is she inherently equal to us? Or do differences between her and us justify stripping her of human rights? Like Dan said, being inside someone, that's a difference. Well, let's explore that together. Do our differences really matter? This could be awkward, but I just want a case study, right? Consider my Uncle Dave and me. Look at Uncle Dave, everyone right now. Yeah, look at Uncle Dave, make him uncomfortable. Look at me. What's the most obvious difference? He's tall, I'm not, right? It's pretty simple. So we differ in that way. He's a lot bigger than I, but there's more to the story, right? Uncle Dave can do a lot of things I can't do. He can build a house. I'm just lucky to survive inside my house, right? There's a lot of things he can do I can't do. He lives here in Indiana. I'm only here in Indiana until I finish this sermon, which may be 2 more hours, right? Then I'm going to be heading home to Ohio. So Uncle Dave, living in the country, I assume is a lot more independent than I am in the burbs, where I rely on a lot of things the government more provides, right? So there are differences among us. You know where I'm going with this, right? Uncle Dave and I differ in many ways. This can be pretty easily demonstrated and documented. But do these differences matter when it comes to our personhood and our human rights? I sure hope not. The more broadly pro-life and more specific Christian worldviews clarify that we do not dismiss the differences among us. We recognize they are there. Indeed, we're the ones, few ones left admitting there is a difference between men and women today, right? We recognize that these differences are there. But we say, our contention is really simply that these differences are irrelevant when it comes to our inherent worth, our value. We hinge human rights not on what we look like, what we can do, but on who we are. We truly take our cue from the word itself, human rights, and hinge our value on our mere humanness. What matters is not your size, your abilities, but who you are. And here's something very interesting about humanness. We all have it to the exact same degree. Uncle Dave may be taller than I am, but he's not more of a human than I am. We're both humans to the same degree. So we can truly say we are inherently equal. Now, we're deep into worldview by this point, right? But here's the point. On the pro-life view, our worth flows from our humanness. And in spite of our differences, this humanness is something we all share equally. So it makes sense to say we are truly inherently equal. What about the pro-choice side? Well, they say our differences matter so much that those who are different are not equal to us. The embryo may be human, but she's so small, so dependent. For example, she can't be a person like us. But when you explore that with them, their view is both uncomfortable and pretty quickly seen to be untenable. But first, take note of what's going on here. Honest abortion advocates agree, yes, she's a human. But they say, but she's different from us and therefore not equal to us. This is unjust. This strikes against our pro-life convictions, against our Christian worldview, and bothers us, and it should bother us. But we don't merely respond with frustration. We must explore that with people. So let's do that together. I mean, let's consider, what are the differences between pre-born humans and born humans? Do they matter? I know many of you know this, but it bears repeating again this morning. You know the difference between pre-born human, born humans. There are only four. They follow the acronym SLED. First, size. Clearly, I mentioned Uncle Dave is taller than me, but we're both taller than every embryo the world has ever seen. Level development. Uncle Dave can build a lot better than me, but I can tell you, I can build a lot better with Legos than any embryo. Maybe that's not a good feat, but hey, I'm more developed than they are, right? They're also in a very unique environment. Daniel Dino told us this, right? They're inside the uterus. We here today, sorry, Wendell, we're not inside the uterus. We're outside. And fourth, embryos depend a lot more on their mothers than any of us do here. These are four very real differences between pre-born humans and born humans. They're smaller, at a lower level of development, in a unique environment, and a lot more dependent on their mother than we are. These are real differences, legitimate differences. But here's the rub. If those four differences make the embryo less of a person, less deserving of human rights, the same is true for all of us, right? If size determines your personhood, I'm less of a person than Uncle Dave. If it's level development, again, he wins. He can build things I cannot. If it's environment, I don't know, we could fight for that one, but Uncle Dave lives here where your taxes are a lot lower, so I'm going to give him the win again, right? He's more of a person than I am. Degree of dependency, I don't know. I mean, Uncle Dave, I assume, I know he's much more mature, advanced. He's much more independent than I am. So again, he wins, I lose. That's uncomfortable for me. But if size, level development, environment, dependency really were what gave us our human, our amount of human value, our rights, we'd quickly come to some very uncomfortable conclusions. Now, for a couple of years, a member of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio gave us a life-size, beautiful illustration of this. She followed us from campus to campus, and she gave the perfect illustration that these differences do not justify stripping any of us of human rights. And her name was Annie. Now, Annie used to come from campus. Annie, you saw what happened, right? Annie used to come to campus with us, but not alone. She would strap this massive purple uterus on top of her sedan, cruise down the highway with ovaries flipping off in the breeze, and they come to campus, unload, put it on her body, and walk onto campus. You'd see her just like walking in the middle of a street with a massive purple uterus over her head, coming in to meet us, and this is her right there. She called this her gender-neutral uterus. I confess to you, I had no idea what she meant by that years ago, and I sadly tell you today, I now understand what she meant. Just took me a while to figure it out. But here's where it got very interesting. Annie, there, would pull down the front of that to where you could not see her. All you could see are two little feet peeping out from the bottom of the uterus when she was on campus next to us. This was so good. I would just talk to students and say, hey, look right there. You cannot see her. She's hidden inside a uterus, but there's a human inside there. It's a unique environment, but do you know she's still a human, right? Same human rights you have and me. It does not change her environment. I sadly have to tell you that soon afterward, Annie stopped coming to her outreaches. Perhaps she was uncomfortable. I don't know. I can't confirm that, but I do know that students become very uncomfortable with this once they realize where their worldview leads them. If size determines personhood, for example, we're all unequal in this room, depending on how great we can stretch our spines, how tall we can get. From tallest to smallest, we all have more or less value, more or less worth based on how tall we are. When pro-choice students understand this, their worldview starts to feel like that t-shirt that shrunk too much in the wash. It doesn't fit quite right anymore. And that starts to bother them. And that's when we get to the really good part. You've clarified the categories. We have a scientific question. We have a worldview question. You've walked them through both. They see that the embryo is a human. They don't like the conclusion that they now realize that their worldview leads to inequality and injustice. And then you offer them the better way, that every human, regardless of our size, our level of development, where we are, or our dependency on things or other people, that every one of us, that we're all created equal. And that's when they're uncomfortable with their views, when they understand the message we're giving, and they see that our message may be better, sometimes someone who previously had no interest in our message may begin to warm to it. I've seen that. I know people here have seen it too. And we can keep advancing that. even when people don't initially want it. Now, this case that we are all equal in spite of our differences, that's exactly what I laid out to Daniel Dino that day at Bowling Green State University, that if being inside someone or something makes you not a person, he lost his rights as soon as he put that T-Rex costume on. But sadly, our conversation was interrupted right then when someone dressed as a wizard flew in on rollerblades. It was a really weird day on campus. So I have not seen him since then. But so let's summarize what we've done this morning. Right, so we know we are facing cities, crowds, individuals who just don't want the truth we have to share. When that's the case, the first thing we have to do is clarify the kinds of questions we are asking in this debate. These come before the answers. Two categories, science and worldview. Science alone will not give us the answer. This could tell us what the embryo is, but not how we should treat her. We also must ask, is she equal to us? Is it moral to kill her? These are broader worldview questions. Once we establish the categories, we can lead people through them to get not only the right questions, but hopefully the right answers. We can answer the scientific question by demonstrating that she is growing. Dead things generally don't grow, so she's living. She must belong to the same species as her parents. If they're humans, she's also human. But is it wrong to kill her? It depends on what you believe about all humans and our value. Christians, atheists, Buddhists, we all must answer this question. So I just tell people, yes, I honestly admit I'm a Christian, guilty as charged. Because of that, I'm committed to equality. What about you? What do you think? Even if you reject my Christianity, do we come to the same conclusion that our differences, though interesting, sometimes important, don't tarnish our personhood? Now, in all of this, our goal has been to bring people to truth, to set babies free. We want the things that make for true peace, right? Peace that babies are no longer starved, suffocated, and swirled down the toilet. Peace that they're no longer decapitated, dismembered, disemboweled, discarded with the common refuse and surgical abortions. But I think there's another kind of peace we all care about here. We know that babies are dying every day. We also know that this means there are throngs of men and women across the country carrying guilt that is often hidden, guilt from what they've done, from their abortions. And some of them are still stuck in their shame. And when I meet them, I find it's again a problem of not asking the right questions. Whatever our hangup may be, until we begin asking the right questions, we'll miss the truth or reject it, even when it's gift-wrapped and presented to us. So the last story I'll tell. One snowy day a couple years ago, Aubrey and I took our kids to Scranton, Pennsylvania, not to find Shrew Farms, but to find before a prayer breakfast I was speaking at. And during my speech, I showed a video, a hard video, of babies killed by abortion. Now, before I did this, I prepared the audience the way I always do. I said that if abortion was in their past, this didn't have to be the end of their story. Where we've been matters, but it matters less than where we're going. What we've done in the past is less important than who we are today. If we believe in Jesus, we are truly forgiven. He became sin in our place. And I also have invited anyone who didn't want to see the video to look away for the 60 seconds. Now, after the event, we packed up, went home. I talked to a lot of people, but there was one person I didn't talk to. When we were driving west on Highway 80, she called me, and her name is Andrea. Andrea would be fine with me telling you this story today. Andrea said she was angry when I said what I was going to do. She had had an abortion 20 years before, finally came to her first ever pro-life event, and there, this man is going to show this picture, this video of abortion. She was not happy with me. And she sat there asking herself, what am I going to do? Do I want to watch this or not watch this? And finally, at the last minute, she decided to look. Looked up right before I pressed play. She told me later she had no clue why she looked up, but something happened after she did. On the phone, Andrea said, it was like a festering wound. All the stuff inside needed to come out. It had been stuck there for so long. When I watched that video, it was like the wound was lanced open, it all came out. And then Andrea said, what matters most, she said, watching that, I understood for the first time in my life what the cross really is for. Now, Andrea had been terrified to look at the reality of her sin because for so long she was asking the wrong question. She kept asking herself, what have I done? Healing finally came when she changed the question from what have I done to what has Christ done? And that was the beginning for Andrea of her healing. She went on to go to a retreat offered by Deeper Still, a ministry committed to biblical healing after abortion. And just last month, she called again to tell Aubrey and I that after years of preparation, she's finally launched her own chapter of Deeper Still in her own corner of Pennsylvania. She's helping other people come to the right answers, healing after abortion, by leading them to ask the right questions, not just questions of how can we feel better, but how can we find true healing in the cross of what Christ has done for us. Andrea reminded me that sharing truth is seldom easy, especially when no one wants it. But it's not impossible. Change still comes. Maybe not as fast as we'd like, but real lasting change is still possible, even today.
Wow, Seth, it's a lot there that you shared with us. A lot of information. It'd be something that we should be listening to again because you covered a lot of ground. Great strategies, great arguments, very impressive. Very impressed with how you've equipped yourself through all this. There's a lot here that we could all learn and apply. I failed to mention because we do have folks who have not been here when you were here the last time. Seth is, what is your title at Created Equal now? Vice President Created Equal. So you've been with them 10 years?
10, we moved out there, so about 13 years.
About 13 years, okay. So we've had a number of our folks here been involved with Created Equal in a number of ways, and most recently with the Justice Rides. All of our youth groups are involved in going to these campuses that you talked about and standing there interacting with the students that walk by and that sort of thing. So it's a very effective ministry, and we appreciate you coming, and thank you so much for everything here this morning. So let's stand, and I will dismiss with these words. Paul writes to the Galatians, "Grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age, according to the will of our God and Father, to whom be glory forever and ever." So upon those words, you are dismissed. Go in Christ's name. Enjoy each other and serve each other in love.